Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Oh, thank you so much, Rob. And I, too, would like to welcome everyone to the Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop, Diverse Populations Living with Multiple Myeloma, Treatment Advances. And today's program is supported by Johnson & Johnson Healthcare Systems. Now, before we begin, I just want to let you all know how many people are on the call and where they're from. So we have over 200 participants on the call today who come from all of the United States, from both urban, rural, and suburban areas. And we also have international participants from Canada, Nepal, and the United Kingdom. So this is a global call as well. And we're delighted to have all of you on this program today who will be listening to this program today. Again, the majority of participants are from the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And now it is my distinct pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Monique Hartley-Brown. And Dr. Hartley-Brown is attending physician, Jerome Lipper, Multiple Myeloma Center, Department of Medical Oncology, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. And Dr. Hartley-Brown will be addressing an overview of diverse populations living with multiple myeloma, how race may impact your access to the treatment of multiple myeloma, how to find your best care team, and current standard of care. It's my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Hartley-Brown.
Thank you so much, Dr. Messner, and thank you for the Cancer Care team for inviting me to join in this conversation today. Thank you most of all to the patients who are listening in and their providers and supporters. Multiple myeloma is a blood cell cancer that is essentially the second most common blood cell cancer in the United States, second to lymphoma. And when we think about diverse populations living with myeloma, for Blacks or Afro-descent individuals, those individuals have a higher incidence of multiple myeloma compared to whites. So when we think about multiple myeloma itself, there's a two-time higher incidence in Afro-descent individuals versus whites in this country. In addition, the precursor conditions to myeloma, which include monoclonal gammopathy of undetermined significance and smoldering multiple myeloma, are about three times as higher in Afro-descent individuals in this country compared to whites. And there's an estimate that in 10 years, Black patients will be approximately 24% of those newly diagnosed with multiple myeloma in the population in this country. And so we have to start thinking about ways in which we can consider this population, because most of these patients are not included in novel therapies or clinical trials. And so when we look at the current situation, we see that survival rates are disproportionately better for whites versus Black patients, and Black and Hispanic patients are diagnosed anywhere from 5 to 10 years younger at the time of diagnosis than their white counterparts. And by that, the average age of diagnosis is around 69, so we're talking about patients who are diagnosed in their late 50s, sometimes early 60s. The other things that we've noticed from review or retrospective trials is there's a lower use of autologous stem cell transplantation and novel therapies in clinical trials in patients of diverse populations. So the BIPOC community, Black, Hispanic, and Indigenous patients are less likely to receive these types of therapy. And therefore, this is actually associated with increased morbidity and mortality outcomes for these these populations. So how do we approach this, knowing this information? Well, we have to look at what the obstacles are and what is preventing our patients from being receiving the therapies that they may need. And there are lots of obstacles that are outside of the healthcare system, and there are lots of obstacles that are within the healthcare system. My focus today is to look into access, but some of these outer systemic social issues will affect access. And by that, I mean, if we think about socioeconomic disparities, if we think about systemic racism, if we think about demographics, environmental and educational issues, as well as policy, all of these things kind of fold into ways that these populations are impaired or delayed in receiving the therapies that they need. Some ways that we can think about social or socioeconomic is when we think about patients in the BIPOC communities, these are patients who may not necessarily have a high income, and so their insurance may not be all-inclusive. They may have suboptimal insurance or no insurance at all. That will affect their healthcare access. Things in terms of demographics, including sexual identity, may also affect their access as well. Environmental, where they live and how easy it is for them to traverse from where their location is, if they have to travel, you know, 100, 200 or more miles to get to an academic institution that offers optimal treatment, that is also something that may affect their healthcare outcomes. And then there's lots of other things in terms of health literacy, understanding what it is that is being discussed. A lot of these concerns, again, fall outside of the healthcare system, but they do heavily impact the healthcare outcomes of these patients. If you don't understand what is being shared with you, the information that's shared, there's going to be an increase in distrust or an increase in misunderstanding, and that may impact your care in general. Policy, institutional policies, national policies, regional policies, may also impact these outcomes. And so to move into ways that we can overcome some of these things, when we think about treating our patients, let's think about these barriers and try to address them. And so in the setting of treating patients with multiple myeloma, partnership with an academic institution can occur earlier, and I would advocate for that. In the case of patients who are in a rural vicinity, unable to access care directly, their oncologic care team or their healthcare team may be able to allow for telemedicine conferences that could infuse the information that's necessary to allow these patients to have access to this information and access to what treatment options are truly available. There's also the development of a lot of travel teams. So we do have, access to potential mobile vehicles, mobile healthcare vehicles. It may be a mobile vehicle that allows for phlebotomy, which is blood draws. It may be a mobile vehicle that allows for nursing to come to remote areas to get the labs done or the physical exams done or certain healthcare treatments done in that location, which would alleviate some of the travel on the patient themselves. So these are some of the ideas that have been brought forth not only institutional-wide, but also through the FDA. These are some of the things that the FDA has talked about. When we talk about clinical trials, it's a whole other realm, but being more inclusive in clinical trial criteria has also been a part of this process. So to essentially highlight the things that we can do. For multiple myeloma, it's a multifaceted disease. It's a disease that affects multiple organs. We are aware that patients may have, abnormal calcium levels, abnormal renal function or kidney function. They may have anemia. They may have bone lesions and bone pain. And these are some of the things that can affect patients with multiple myeloma. And so sometimes that means they need more than just the oncology provider. They may need a kidney doctor. They may need support from another provider in terms of support for their bone pain, such as an orthopedic physician. So it's a multifaceted approach to help these patients going forward. And so I think, some of the things that we can do in terms of allowing better access and empowering our patients is early patient education, allowing the patients to learn earlier what is multiple myeloma and how it affects the body and how they can contact or reach out to their local provider who can connect with a specialist in this field. And there's lots of ways you can do that. One of the ways can be online through different resources such as the International Myeloma Society or the Myeloma Research Foundation. There are many resources that are available to patients with this disease. Early discussion by the provider with the patient on clinical trials and novel treatments. If the novel treatments are not available in that particular location, then partnering with a academic institution and partnering with a provider at an academic institution is going to be key and to be done early to allow for that early discussion to take place and to allow the patient to have optimal exposure to these treatment options. Early inclusion of strategies such as, provision of transportation to locations that will provide the patient with care that they need. Transportation to these academic institutions that will allow clinical trial access or novel therapies such as the monoclonal antibodies like daratumumab, also known as Darzalex, or CAR T therapy such as Ide-cel, Captogene, which is and Cilta-cel, which is Carvykti, and Becca. So all of these treatment options are readily available, but they are available at academic institutions. So the partnership early on is going to be key. And then recognizing that support strategies are important, such as supplemental providers, social workers, patient navigators, and patient advocates, et cetera, roping in these teams early in the process is going to be very important. And I would enhance the fact that if we start to do this early on with our local providers partnering with our academic institutions, then we can, improve upon access for all our patients, including those within the BIPOC community, especially our Afro-descent Americans, Black Americans, who are more often diagnosed with multiple myeloma, as well as the Hispanics who are also diagnosed at a younger age. And if we can do that, we can also address some of the social determinants of health that I believe one of the other speakers later today is going to address in terms of, overcoming some of these obstacles in multiple myeloma care as well as in access to clinical trials. We have to be proactive about these things and be inclusive with early strategies for improving these outcomes for patients in these communities. And with that, I really want to say thank you so much for including me in this conversation, and I'll hand it back over to Dr. Messner. Sorry.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Hartley Brown. That was really just an extraordinary presentation. You really set the stage for today's program, and you identified so many different issues that I think will be followed up by some of the other speakers, but you really identified a lot of issues and concerns for both the participants on the call, and because this program will be is recorded and will be available as a podcast within a couple of days after the program, will be available to so many more to listen to. So thank you so much for an outstanding, stellar presentation and setting the tone for the entire program. So thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Matthew Butler. Dr. Butler is Assistant Professor of Medicine, Division of Hematology Oncology, Department of Medicine, Mays, MD, Anderson Cancer Center, UT Health, San Antonio. And Dr. Butler will be addressing new and emerging treatments, including reducing complications of bone disease, the role of transplantation, and preventing and managing treatment side effects, symptoms, discomfort, pain, and addressing quality of life concerns. It's really my great pleasure, my distinct pleasure, to introduce to you my esteemed colleague, Dr. Butler.
Thank you so much, and I always really enjoy doing these programs. I hope they're helpful to people. So I talk to a lot of people with myeloma at different stages of the disease, and so I'll try to touch on some of the things that have changed in recent years as far as what medicines we use and the emerging treatments, some of which have already been mentioned. I won't try to go into every last drug and every new study that's coming out. There's a really kind of a constant stream of new research in myeloma, it's hard to stay on top of all of it. But I'll highlight some things that are actually relevant and hopefully can help people that are on this call. The big picture of treating myeloma is that it's a chronic disease. It's a disease that you will live with. It's not a disease that you're ever going to get to sort of be able to forget about or have it go away. We dream of achieving that. There's lots of people working hard on curative treatments, but at this point in time, we don't have them. So managing side effects and quality of life and pain and having the treatment be something that you can live with and continue to be the person you are and do the things that you do, that has to be at the part of the conversation at every stage. If we have a treatment that makes your numbers look great but means that you don't have enough energy to work or to take care of your kids or to or you're in pain a lot of the time, that's not okay, and that's not good management of the disease. The treatment has to be tolerable and sustainable, something you can stick with, because dealing with myeloma is a long term thing. It's not an over and done with thing that you just try to get through. The biggest change that I would say in terms of the number of people affected, is not these emerging and really already emerged now cellular therapies, although I'll mention those at the end, but it's changing the upfront treatment. We've added a drug called daratumumab. It's not a new drug. It's been around since 2016, but it's now more and more being part of the standard initial treatment, like on day one after you're diagnosed with myeloma. More and more centers are offering daratumumab as part of that initial therapy, either in addition to the other drugs that have been standard or instead of one of those drugs. There's an older drug called bortezomib or Velcade that can cause some kind of unpleasant side effects, and we sometimes like to get rid of it. But for someone who's young and we think can handle the most effective treatments that we have, we combine all of these drugs together, a total of four drugs. There's a trade-off with side effects, but it's actually not that bad a trade-off, and it really seems to be worth it in terms of how people do. I think this is the study that really cemented this practice came out it was published last December. I think it highlights kind of incidentally one of the issues that this particular session today is wrestling with, which is the access to treatment, access to research, and access to the latest drugs is not at all equal. It depends on where you live, what kind of community you come from, what kind of insurance you have, what kind of center you can get to, and that's reflected if you look at the enrollment numbers on this study. It's called the Perseus trial, really important piece of research, but it's the subjects were overwhelmingly white, 93% somewhere in the low 90s. And we know that doesn't reflect the population of people that lives with this disease. I don't think the fault of the people that designed the study. It wasn't designed to exclude anyone. It was just where it was conducted. This particular one is mostly done in European centers that just don't have very diverse populations to draw from. But it's part of a larger, phenomenon that the kinds of very academic and very privileged areas where a lot of this research happens look quite different from where a lot of the patients are. And we're trying to find ways to bridge that gap. I work at a place that we try to really be conscious of research participation and make sure that we're making it easier for people to be part of it, and try to get a more balanced understanding of how these drugs affect people. In the meantime, unfortunately, we just have to go with the research that we have. And I would never want to deny someone access to these drugs just because they were studied in a different population. I think that daratumumab or Darzalex is a really effective treatment. It's very well tolerated, and I've given it to all different kinds of people. That is something to know about at your initial treatment, is that the question of whether to use this drug may hinge on where you go, and it's gradually being adopted, at least in the United States. Of course, other countries, there may be other barriers to getting access to new drugs like this. When myeloma comes back, if the initial treatments often work very well, and we're trying to get that better and better, and have the remissions that we get last longer and longer, the important way we do this is still one of the oldest, which is called stem cell transplantation. I'm not going to get into too much detail about what that is, other than I tell people not to be intimidated by it. It's not like other kinds of transplantation where you get something from someone else and you need a donor and it may or may not agree with you. That's true of organ transplants, and it's true of some stem cell transplants. But the kinds that are used for myeloma, we use the patient's own cells, meaning they match with them perfectly, and there's never an issue with rejection. So transplant is a process that helps remissions to last a lot longer than they would otherwise, meaning that at the time when you're doing the best with your disease, the disease is under the best control. That's when the transplant is the most helpful. Even though it seems like when it's doing the best, we can back off and the treatment should get easier, and eventually it does. But it gets a little harder before it gets easier as you go through this transplant process. Once once that's been done, and it, you know, it's not done for everybody. It's a decision that ultimately the patient makes. But you know, often your doctor will have a strong opinion about whether you're a good candidate for it or not. Not everyone is, and if we try it for the wrong person, it can do more harm than good. But you know, life should get back to normal. And this is where, in the maintenance setting, where the disease is under very good control, we want that to last for as long as it possibly can. And we want you to be able to live normally during that time. And that means, you know, getting back to physical activities, making sure that pain is still addressed. Pain may go away or it may stay with you and need to be managed. And then we watch for signs of relapse. And if that happens, that is not the end of the road. That's just another chapter in your journey with the disease. We have a bunch of treatments for relapse. And the latest ones are the cellular therapies. This is another source of disparity because only the biggest and most advanced centers can do this. And in many countries, it's not available at all. And within a place like the United States, it's not available to large numbers of people who don't happen to be near or be able to get to an academic center that does it. You know, figuring out how to make these things more available is a big challenge. And it's, I would say it's improving, but it's improving slowly. It does offer an option, and it offers hope for in situations where the more traditional treatments aren't getting us where we want to be. That's something you may hear about as you go through. What I tell people though is you don't need to rush it. There's no benefit to going to the latest leading edge therapy when the tried and true options are still viable. You don't need to skip over good treatments to get one that's newer. It's not just because it's newer doesn't mean it's better. It's only really necessary when standard treatments have stopped working. And in a lot of cases that the standard treatments are all you need. So I think I could go on, but I'm mindful of the time. So I will pass it off to the next speaker.
Thank you so much, Dr. Butler. That was really just a wonderful presentation. Again, stellar. And also, you covered a lot of different issues and with a great deal of compassion and expertise. And so thank you. I know there will be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Elizabeth O'Donnell. And Dr. O'Donnell is clinical Director of Early Detection and Prevention of Cancer, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Assistant Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School, and Dr. O'Donnell will be addressing lifestyle, physical activity, and balance concerns with practical tips and guidelines to prepare for appointments, including prepared list of questions, follow-up care, and discussion of open notes. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. O'Donnell.
Good afternoon, and thank you so much for the warm welcome and the invitation to talk about activity for myeloma patients. This is an area that's of particular interest to me as we think about having a cancer diagnosis and the effects that it can have on your life. Many patients want to know about the things that they can do to help themselves outside of just the medications required for the treatment of disease. One of the questions that comes up very frequently is physical activity. And so physical activity covers a broad range of things, from the activities of daily living, chores around the house, laundry, things of that nature, to getting out and doing exercise, things like walking or riding a bicycle or jogging. And so one of the really important takeaways for any patient, particularly those with multiple myeloma, is that activity can be very good for you, both on a physical level and on an emotional well-being level. Physical activity is associated with improved quality of life, less fatigue, and potentially less depression and anxiety. But physical activity can take many different forms. When a patient has multiple myeloma, the first step is to begin with a conversation with your treatment team, particularly if you have bone involvement for your multiple myeloma. There are resources for patients that can be used if physical activity is desired, such as physical therapy. Any patient with cancer can be referred to physical therapy for supervised activity, and particularly in patients who may have bone disease, for activities that are suited to your individual needs. And, you know, physical activity, like I said, can take all types of shapes and forms. It can be, you know, doing the laundry, preparing food, gardening, or it can be something more rigorous if your team feels that it's allowable. One of the really important things is to minimize sedentary time or inactivity as well. And so if, for example, you're talking on the phone, on your cell phone, rather than being seated or on the couch, that's an opportunity to move, to get up, to use your body. Everybody likes dancing. Put on some music. Move your body. Set a period of time every day where you engage in that type of activity. That's certainly good for your health and probably good for your soul, too. But if you do desire more structured activity, it's important, as I mentioned, to first clear that with your physician and then to think about where you are so that you can build up. You know, you may need to start with a more restricted amount of activity and build up over time to achieving a moderate level of activity where you're getting your heart rate up and feel that in your breathing. We do have to be careful with multiple myeloma in terms of weight lifting or weight bearing activities. So again, do discuss them, but absolutely consider them as part of your ongoing care. And in addition, I think communication with your primary team is critical. Your doctor, your nurse practitioner, your PA, your nursing, everybody on that team is here to help you. And so as you think about preparing for your visits, make sure that you come with a list of your considerations. If you have a family member or care team partner that can come with you to help you in that preparation, that's also really effective. We really want, as your care team, to optimize your quality of life, your happiness, your well-being. And so it's important when we have those visits together that that time be optimized and, you know, making a list in advance of that visit and really thinking about your questions and considerations before you arrive and having someone there, if possible, to make sure that those are expressed is really critical for excellent care, which is what we all strive for. So thank you so much again for the invitation. It's wonderful to be here, and have a nice afternoon.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. O'Donnell. That was so helpful and so wonderful for our participants to hear about the importance of physical activity and how to work with the healthcare team to best, figure out ways that you can stay active during your cancer treatment. It's so important. So thank you so much. Just a wonderful presentation. And our next speaker is Dr. Maria Chi. And Dr. Chi is clinical oncology social worker, author, and researcher, healthcare disparities, social determinants of health, psychosocial oncology, and financial toxicity. And Dr. Chi will be addressing social determinants of health, including languages spoken, and health literacy, food insecurity and food deserts, tips to increase your access to health, promoting nutrition, and how to cope with health care disparities. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Chi.
Social determinants of health are conditions in our environment, including where we were born and raised, where we grew up, and our environment now, where we live, where we go to work and school, even where we may get our cancer treatment and other health care. These aspects of our environment are important because they affect our quality of life and health outcomes, both our risk of getting certain diseases and how well we do with them once we get them. There are five main categories of social determinants of health. The first is economic factors. meaning our ability to earn a steady income and access to job opportunities. The second is our neighborhood, our immediate environment, and access to things like clean water, safe housing, and transportation. The third are social and community factors, things such as our exposure to structural inequalities, discrimination, or disparities, versus opportunities to participate in meaningful social activities. The fourth would be healthcare factors, including our access to nutritious food and places for physical activity or exercise. And then finally, there are educational factors, our access to quality schools, access to education and reading materials in our primary language, and our community's literacy rates, including health literacy. In particular, having access to education and literature, especially in the healthcare environment, in our primary language, affects our ability to access certain procedures like preventive screenings, such as breast or colon cancer screenings. Language barriers may also lead to miscommunication between patients and healthcare providers, which also affects the quality and safety of our care. Many hospitals and clinics offer in-person or telephone interpreter services, which help remedy this, but are costly and time-consuming. Health literacy is the degree to which we can find, understand, and use health-related information to make healthcare decisions for ourselves. Organizational health literacy is the degree to which healthcare institutions help us find and understand the health info we need to make these decisions. So our hospitals and treatment centers also have a responsibility to ensure access to material and services that we can actually use. For example, are there pamphlets and brochures or info on their websites at a level that most of us can understand without too much medical jargon or confusing explanations? Are they offered in our primary language? Unfortunately, we know that lower health literacy is associated with more hospitalizations, fewer cancer screenings, and overall poorer health status. One thing you can do on a personal level is to advocate for yourself. Ask your healthcare provider if your hospital or clinic has an interpreter service, either in person or by phone, that can facilitate your visit. Another social determinant of health in the healthcare category has to do with food insecurity or not having consistent access to safe, nutritious food, which in turn can make chronic health problems worse. Food insecurity affects approximately 41 million Americans. Related to food insecurity are so-called food and pharmacy deserts. Basically, these are neighborhoods with very few or limited number of pharmacies and grocery stores or markets, where you may have to travel a longer way to reach them. Technically, this is more than half a mile in cities and more than 10 miles in rural areas. As we know, if you're homebound, have mobility issues, or are immunocompromised from cancer or treatment, this makes access to pharmacies and grocery stores even more of a barrier. Fortunately, there are resources to help cope with these healthcare disparities. For example, ask your local pharmacy or grocery store if they deliver. Many do, and some do this for free. You can also look for local food banks and pantries or food distribution programs, which exist all over the country. Go to foodpantries.org or feedingamerica.org to find your local food bank. You can also look for soup kitchens, sometimes through churches or other religious organizations, or nearby senior centers that offer free hot lunches or breakfast. To see if you're eligible for food stamps or the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, go to www.nutrition.gov. Meals on Wheels also has food distribution programs for seniors all over the country. Furthermore, advocate for yourself and ask your hospital social worker, case manager, patient navigators, RN case managers, or registered dietitian about these resources and where to find them in your community, or call Cancer Care's Hopeline for help in locating them. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Chi. That was just a wonderful presentation. I just want to let everybody know that we will be sending a Survey Monkey. It's an evaluation of the program. But in the Survey Monkey will be any resource that any of the speakers provided, and we'll probably add some other resources as well. So all the resources that Dr. Chi provided will be in the Survey Monkey evaluation. And it will also be, we may add some other things as well to other speakers who've given you links to things and things like that. So I know you were trying to write this down quickly, but I just want to let you know that these resources will be provided after the program as well, so you can access them. And they're wonderful resources, so please take advantage of them. And our next speaker is Ms. Diana Bearden, and Ms. Bearden is an oncology dietitian with the Michael E. DeBakey VA Medical Center. and she'll be addressing nutrition and hydration concerns and tips for caregivers. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Bearden.
Thank you so much, Carolyn. I'm excited to be part of today's presentation. And so nutrition and hydration are key, not only to the tolerance to your treatment, but also to your quality of life. Nutrition is fundamental for everybody, and a lot of times figuring out how to make nutritious food choices can be a little challenging, especially when we see a lot of different things in the media and in the grocery store and what's available to us and how do we make it work for us as individuals. So I want to give you guys some tips today on how to do that. A plant-based diet is what we want to aim for. Now, a plant-based diet, kind of translating that into an imagery on your plate, is about two-thirds of your plate being covered with a plant-based food. Now, these are things like whole grains, fruits, vegetables, nuts, and seeds. These particular foods are important because they have unique qualities that bring special nourishment to our body, things like antioxidants, polyphenols, fiber, and phytochemicals. Now, I want to bring something up that a lot of people don't know. When we're looking at making some economical choices, I mean, today's world, we're all very aware of that, and accessing things are sometimes more challenging for some than others, just depending where you live. I want people to know that things like dried beans are a perfect way to do it. It's very economical. You can prepare them in a crock pot, freeze them, put them in the freezer, and then use them at a later date. We can also buy a lot of foods, like our fruits and veggies, frozen. They're actually better for us, nourishment-wise, than fresh because they're allowed to ripen completely on the vine. They're cut and cleaned and then put in the freezer. There is not a need to look at labels. I tell people all the time, go with the store brand. It's just as good. It's equitable as any other brand that's on the shelf. So sometimes that can be a little confusing for patients as well. And then our whole grains. These are things like oatmeal, rice, quinoa. Get these in their dried form. Prepare them. You can cook them ahead. They're good for a week. You can actually cook them and even freeze them. So you don't have to do this on a regular basis with, you know, your busy schedule. Sometimes meal prepping can be a great option. The other part of our plate is going to come from our protein sources. Now, protein, it can come in plant-based foods, so things like beans, peas, and lentils, all of which you can get dried or even canned, and those are all good for you. And then you can even get our animal-based proteins canned, things like tuna, sardines, salmon. They're just as good as buying it in the fish department at the grocery store. Some people don't realize that, and that's because it's not advertised well. But I want you to know those are just as good for you. And they're things that are shelf-stable. If you're on the go, you can always use those a little bit more easily because they don't have to be refrigerated. If your storage space is limited, it's also a great option. So you don't have to do expensive options to eat healthy, and there are economical ways to do that and still nourish yourself. Now, when we're talking about the protein sources, I did bring up our canned salmon, tuna, and sardines, but also chicken. Chicken is a fantastic canned product. You can get canned chicken breast, and it's very, very nourishing. And then sometimes, like I said, just making it an all plant-based food using beans, peas, or lentils. Now, some things to know about why I'm talking about bringing these foods into your diet is protein is important for building blocks of tissue and cell development, which is important when you're going through treatment. There might be some needs to modify your diet throughout your treatment, and talk with your health care team. Your dietitian can help you do that, and she or he can also help you make those selections that are available for you. And all foods fit. We will make it work for you as an individual. Hydration is something that oftentimes gets looked over, but I want to tell people that water is the best way to hydrate. I know we get a lot of different things in the media, you know, special drinks that are out there, and actually water is the best way to hydrate. If your water is safe to drink, just get it out of the faucet. Some people use a filter. If tastes and things like that are specific for you. Most people need between 8 and 10 8-ounce glasses of water a day. Other things that are also hydrating are things like milk. If you like sports drinks, if you like juice, those all fall into the category as a hydrating liquid. I always encourage patients, if you're experiencing side effects, something that's different than normal, your baseline, talk with your healthcare team as quickly as possible. If certain foods are bothering you and you're reacting differently, write those things down. Bring it to your healthcare team. Ask to meet with your dietitian. A dietitian's part of your healthcare team. And so I want to let you all know we're here to support you during your throughout your journey and during your treatment plan, and we want to help be a resource for you. So please reach out to us sooner rather than later, and we're all part of the team, and we're here for you. I'm going to go ahead and conclude and hand the line back over to Carolyn.
Ms. Burden, that was a wonderful presentation, and actually full of information for everybody about how to get, really how to access really good products that are frozen and canned. Without having, if you're in an area that does not have really fresh vegetables and fruits. But canned chicken is a really nice option to be aware of as well. So thank you so much. Thanks as always. And our next speaker is Ms. Lori Feingold. Pull this up just a minute. Our next speaker is Ms. Lori Feingold, and Ms. Feingold is an oncology social worker at Cancer Care, and she'll be addressing Cancer Care's free programs and services, as well as giving you information about how to contact Cancer Care. It's really my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Feingold.
Everybody who's took the time to discuss this important topic, I'd like to tell you a little bit about Cancer Care Services. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization providing free professional support services and information to help people manage the emotional, practical, and financial challenges of cancer. Our comprehensive services include resource navigation, online support groups, educational programs, community programs, publications, and potential financial and co-payment assistance for medications. Now, I'd like to give you a little bit more information about our services. Our resource navigation service involves a short-term, strengths-based approach to finding additional support and resources, either emotional or financial, for people with cancer or their caregivers. Our national online support groups take place using password-protected message boards and are led by oncology social workers who offer support and guidance. Groups are held for 15 weeks at a time, and you can register on our website to join an online support group that's specific to you. We have specific groups for blood cancer patients, as well as new groups for special audiences, like Spanish-speaking patients and LGBTQ+ female caregivers. On Cancer Care's website, cancercare.org, we also have a wide range of reading material and educational support organized by cancer type and topic. This includes recorded Connect education workshops, similar to this one, publications, our podcast, Cancer Care Out Loud, where you can hear conversations with people with cancer, caregivers, survivors, and other people impacted by cancer. We also offer a variety of community programs, like our Coping Circle workshop series on clinical trials, and a series geared toward young adults with cancer. People can register for many of our programs online or through our Hope Line. You know, as others have mentioned on this call, navigating a multiple myeloma diagnosis is not something you have to go through alone as a patient or a caregiver. By calling our Hope Line at 1-800-813-4673, if you live in the U.S. and Puerto Rico, you have access to Cancer Care Oncology social workers who can help connect you with support. Building community and reaching out for help isn't always easy, but it's important to maintain your support systems and coping strategies when dealing with a multiple myeloma diagnosis. So that's a little bit about our services, and now I'd like to pass it back to Dr. Messner.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And so now we're going to move on to the Q&A. And I'm going to ask Rob to explain to you how to queue up and ask an online question. Rob?
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. At this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
This question for Dr. Hartley Brown. How are current research and clinical trials being modified to reach diverse populations that include minority patients? Do you know of any current clinical trials that are looking for diverse representation?
Thanks for this question. This is a very good question. I think we are in the stage of making changes to clinical trials to allow for adapting and recognizing some of the systemic barriers that exist. So we, you know, there are things that are being considered, including, you know, some of the things that I mentioned earlier in my discussion, where we are thinking of including mobile units and remote access by use of telemedicine to allow for patients who may not necessarily be able to come to the academic centers routinely, but still have access to these research options. You know, determination is a clinical trial that was performed and completed in the past couple of years. It was discussed and put in publication a year ago. Well, I'm sorry, this is 2024, so it'll be 2022. But, you know, that was an example of a clinical trial where there were proactive thoughts about how to include patients of underrepresented populations. And so I think we can extrapolate from that. There are newer therapies. I think some of the off-the-shelf therapies, meaning therapies that do not require excessive resources, will be amenable to some of these clinical trials in the community setting. So, you know, small molecules and, you know, therapies that can be given intravenously or subcutaneously are being increased. We have a lot of bispecific therapies, talquetamab or Talvey, teclistamab. These are all therapies that are newer, and they're bispecific therapies that can be given subcutaneously. So there are trials that are looking at these therapies in earlier lines of therapy, not waiting until the fourth or fifth line. And some of these therapies, I think, can be utilized in the community setting, as well as some of the small molecules and some of the cell mods, such as mezigdomide and iberdomide, which are being looked at in clinical trials. So we do have things that are coming, and I think we are learning more about how to be more inclusive rather than exclusive.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And another question for you. See, my father was recently diagnosed with multiple myeloma and is currently going to the cancer center closest to his home. English is his second language. So I'm interested in any interpreter or translator services. Would we need to find someone on our own, or is it likely the center could help us?
So most centers will have a way to assist and help with translational services. I don't know what your your father's primary language is, but there should be resources in place to assist you with that. So I would suggest asking your provider and or your healthcare team to see if they have services on site. And if they don't, sometimes the treatment facilities, for example, the location where, the industry where that's supplying the medications that he's being treated with, might have interpreter services that can help to highlight or explain a little bit better what the medications are and what the side effects of those medications are. Another option is to reach out to cancer care support services such as American Cancer Society or Multiple Myeloma Research Foundation or International Myeloma Society or International Myeloma Foundation. These are some examples of resources that you can reach out to if you're not able to be offered the resources that you need in your on-site institution.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And this is a question from Ms. Feingold. I live in a more rural community, which is not a walkable area, and I've had a hard time finding resources or groups. I would like to exercise more, but I'm unsure how to move past this. Do you have any recommendations on where to start?
Thank you for that question. And what I would suggest is you can start by calling our Hope Line, and we offer our resource navigation service. And that service enables you to have 3 half-hour sessions with one of our navigators, and they would do an assessment of your needs and help find resources to address them, whether it's a support group. Sometimes there's, we can find exercises for people with cancer. We would just look at what your specific situation is and then provide those resources. And you can, you'll reach out to those resources and come back to for subsequent sessions to if you have questions or if you're stuck or you need some additional assistance. Our Hope Line is a tremendous wealth of information. It's staffed by all master's level oncology social workers who've been, you know, trained in the various aspects of cancer. And daily we're working with people with cancer and caregivers. So that would be a really good place for you to start to move forward on that goal.
Excellent, thank you. And a question for Dr. Hartley Brown. It's the last question we'll take. When would a stem cell transplant not be advisable, and is there any detriment to not having a transplant?
That's a very good question. Transplant has been a part of the backbone of multiple myeloma treatment for several decades. We keep circling back to that question of, do we still need to do transplant? And every time we circle back to that question, we still find that it seems like transplant is worth doing. The problem we have right now is to determine who benefits most from a transplant and who can we defer a transplant in. And that's something that I think, when we look at the IMF trial versus the determination trial, we're seeing that in patients who are treated with a stem cell transplant up front, there are some patients who really don't necessarily need the stem cell transplant in the upfront setting. The problem is we're not clear as of yet, based on the clinical trial data, as to how to best identify the patients that would not require stem cell transplant. I would say that if you have standard risk multiple myeloma, then you do have an option here. That being said, standard risk is based on information that sometimes is not fully helpful in terms of identifying true standard risk. That's the one thing. The second thing I would say is, if you're truly standard risk and you defer transplant to a later time frame, it doesn't seem to make a huge impact on your overall survival. However, we do have a lot of newer therapies that were not included in those trials. So, you know, both the IMF and the determination trial looked at triplet therapy with transplant. It did not look at quadruplet therapy with transplant. And so we do have the Perseus trial that did look at, you know, quadruplet therapy, but the data is not as mature as the determination information. And we still don't have a good way of, identifying those patients who would clearly benefit from transplant versus those patients who may not necessarily get the benefit or the heavy lift of the benefit of transplant. So at this time, what I can tell you is transplant is has a role in treatment of multiple myeloma and can deepen your response in treatment. And so if it is offered to you, you want to consider it, but really consider the pros and the cons of the treatment itself and your stage of disease at the time of diagnosis and whether you would want to proceed with that process. Because you can collect your stem cells early and then utilize transplant later. And then with the setting of CAR-T therapy and some of these bispecifics and these other novel T-cell engaging therapies, we don't really know what that translates to. So those therapies are available to you as well. So, you know, if you're not inclined to transplant, you know, don't feel like you're making yourself boxed out of that option, because that option is still available if you collect your stem cells early on.
That's really... Thank you so much. That's fantastic. Thank you so much for addressing this question so comprehensively, Dr. Holly Brown. And I'm going to ask each of our speakers to provide a takeaway. I'm just going to have Dr. Hartley Brown and Ms. Feingold to just provide a takeaway for our participants today. So I'll start with Dr. Hartley Brown. Just a minute or a half takeaway that you'd like people to take away from today's program.
I would like, thank you. I would like you to understand that we don't have all the answers to multiple myeloma treatment, but we do have great treatments in multiple myeloma. And despite what your option or what your choice is, if you are linked with a provider in an academic institution that knows very well about multiple myeloma treatment and can offer you the optimal therapies and the optimal options, you are in a good space. So I think that's the key. And if we can provide that for most of our patients or all of our patients, that would be essential. And that's what I would want to leave with you today.
Well, thank you so much. And Ms. Feingold?
I think it's important. We recognize that, you know, cancer is a difficult disease to navigate. And, you know, whether you're the patient or you're a caregiver, you often feel alone and overwhelmed by everything you have to do, whether it's a medical issue, whether it's financial, emotional. And I want you to walk away knowing that there are resources out there. I mean, all the services Cancer Care offers are free. And as I mentioned earlier, we cover pretty much everything. We don't cover medical, but all that those other resources and support that you may need, we can help you. If we don't offer it within our organization, we can find organizations that can help you. So I want you to know that you're not alone in this process. And there are people and resources out there to give you connection and support.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you. And I do want to comment about the program today. We obviously were not able to take everyone's questions, so I want to comment on the questions. And I also want to comment the fact that this was an extraordinary program because although we have, this is a program that both the speakers and the participants really made this a great program. I want to applaud our speakers who are really phenomenal, and I want to applaud those who were able to ask questions today as well. Always good questions from all of you, and very, very well-informed questions. Now, for those of you who asked a question, for those of you who are still in queue to ask a question, and for those of you who are thinking of a question, please go back to your treating healthcare team. They know you the best, and please ask your question of the team. Remember, they have access to your medical records. They know all the details about your situation. And so you can, and you have learned a lot from being on this program today. So you want to take the information you've learned, share it with your physicians, and also ask your question of them. And ask it as often as you need to so that you get the answers that you need. Also, please be aware of getting phone numbers on your, you know, during the day, business hours, usually there is someone available to take your calls. But the question is, what happens evenings, weekends, and holidays? And so be sure to, and it seems like that's when things always seem to crop up for people. So please do ask your healthcare team, who do you call weekends, evenings, and holidays? That's really important for you to have. And I just want to reiterate what Ms. Feingold said. We don't want anyone to leave this program feeling you're alone. We want you to now know that you're part of a community of support. We're to help you. And we're going to provide for you all the resources that were mentioned in addition to Cancer Care, all the organizations I mentioned as resources for you to get additional information from. And also, please take advantage of our resource navigation staff. If we don't have it, we'll connect you to what has it, so we will definitely not leave you in the lurch with anything that you're concerned about. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.